Welcome to the Development Policy Centre. In this podcast, you'll hear Rim Elkadi discussing some of the challenges of implementing donor-driven reform and resource management in Lebanon. We hope you enjoy the podcast.
Okay, well, good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for coming today. My name is Stephen Howes and I direct the Development Policy Centre, and we host a number of seminars, and we're very happy to be hosting this seminar today. So Dr. Rim Elkadi is a colleague at the ANU. She's an associate here at the Development Policy at our Development Policy Centre. She's actually employed in the Registrar's Office, so she works on student admin and IT issues, but she has a strong academic background and interest in development, and this is basically her PhD thesis, and which she did at the University of South Australia. She presented at our AID conference, which we have every February. But I thought it was very interesting and had a lot of broader lessons for aid going to fragile states, which a lot of us work on. So at the aid conference, you only get a short time to present, so I thought it'd be good to have a fuller presentation. And it's taken us a while to find a date that works, but we have now. So Rim will talk for about 40 minutes and present her findings, and then we'll open it up for Q&A. So thanks very much, Rim, and please welcome her to the podium.
Thank you very much, Stephen, and thank you for the opportunity to present today. I'll actually focus my presentation today on two of the findings from my PhD. So in that aspect, it will be a bit different from the much shorter version of the conference, but I will try to focus on two factors that emerged from my findings as being important to analyze the reform, water sector reform issues in Lebanon, which is, considered a fragile state. So the first of those two factors is the sectarian political system that characterizes Lebanon. And the second is obviously the role, and I'm going to look at how these two factors actually interact with the unfolding of the reform and how they affect the actual process of the reform and the outcomes. So what motivates this research? In fact, after more than a decade of passing the Law 221, which was the water sector reform law in 2000, and despite receiving more than $2 billion in foreign aid to the water sector, the sector is still facing the same challenges. 2010 World Bank report found the sector as still, quote, not in line with the economic development reached by the country, unquote, and the estimated the cost of inaction in the sector to over 3% of GDP. Another more recent report of the World Bank in 2016 presented the factor as still facing, quote, acute challenges, unquote. In fact, the sector challenges are reported in the literature at the beginning of the post-war reconstruction period in 1992 still persist now, more than a decade after the start of the reform. During this time, only minor changes, minor improvements were reported, whether in domestic water availability, quality and reliability, or in wastewater management, or even in improving irrigation efficiencies. And institutional weakness is a recurrent theme when the water sector in Lebanon is discussed. So basically, this begs the question of whether the lack of progress in the sector is actually due to an intrinsic feature of the Lebanese political and social context, or to an aspect of the reform approach. And actually, two questions contribute to answering that main question. What is the impact of the sectarian political system, and what is the role of aid in that regard? So, obviously, the research draws on multiple theoretical and literature themes across sustainable development, water resource management, development aid, and institutional theory, among others. And just I won't delve into that, but I will stop here to present a concept that will come back during the presentation. And so this is the concept of integrated water resources management that was advanced by the Global Water Partnership formed in 1996 and basically promoted and by the World Bank and UNDP, the UNDP following the 1992 Rio conference. So to facilitate the organization and analysis of the research problem and findings, I've used a framework that I have developed through the multiple iterations between data collection, data analysis and interpretation, and the literature reviews as a way to confirm or inform emerging concepts and findings. This is a simplified version of the framework I have used. The central part consists of the reform stages from the law formulation to its implementation and further amendments to the outcome assessment phases. And the central stream also includes any pre-reform or future reform plans that are of relevance to the research questions. The role of the local context and actors and foreign context and actors presented on each side and interacting with the central reform process is actually key to understanding the institutional change and or action situation in relation to the reform, and hence constitute an important part of the framework. So I've used a mixed methodology of qualitative and quantitative methods. 43 interviews were conducted with key informants across the public sector and who were employed in either the Ministry of Energy and Water, water establishments, or other public sector areas that were relevant to the water sector, and as well as a number of donor organizations representatives. I've also received funding from the German bilateral aid organization, GIZ, to conduct a 1,000 household survey. So, sectarianism in Lebanon. So, Lebanon is officially home to 18 different religious, Christian, and Muslim sects, and its political system is commonly described as a consociational democracy or sectarian system or confessional system because of the social and political segmentation that separates the various confessional communities. The sectarian divisions and power sharing through a mixed representation of the religious groups in Lebanon can be actually traced to the 19th century, where the first independent or semi-autonomous minority districts were formed under the Ottoman Empire. And later on, in the 1920s, the very creation of the first state of Lebanon was to provide the minority of Christian Maronites with a safe haven in a predominantly Muslim Middle East. Later on, with the independence, the 1943 National Pact actually institutionalized this religion-based proportional representation and power sharing amongst the various sects of the Lebanese state, to include Christian and Muslim religious sectarian groups. This power sharing was, there's a debate as to whether this actually led to the 1975 civil war or was not able to prevent it. But nevertheless, in 1975, that was the start of a 15-year civil war that was ended in 1990 with another sort of agreement brokered by a number of international powers and hosted by the by Saudi Arabia. This agreement again formalized, slightly modified in favor to the growing Muslim population, but put in place a more institutionalized version of the same power sharing arrangement. Under that, with that agreement, the president now should be Christian Maronite, the prime minister Muslim Sunni, the speaker of the house Muslim Shia. Public sector positions and high-ranking government appointments were also to be distributed equally among Christians and Muslims. So the consociational power sharing model, originally thought as a way to establish peace, is increasingly being critiqued now on many fronts, including slower decision making, undermining individual merit in favor of proportionality, a weak opposition, and crystallization of societal divides. And the findings that I have collected actually confirm these issues in all basically public sector matters, and particularly the water sector. So just very quickly, a little bit about Lebanon, a very small country of just over 10,000 square kilometers, around 4 million, a population of around 4 million, a topography that doesn't lend itself to good water capture, and basically prone to groundwater pollution, high density coastal cities, particularly the area of Beirut, and majority of produced water goes to agriculture at about 60 to 70%, and 20 to 30% goes to domestic uses and the balance to industrial uses. My findings confirm other studies that actually show a social divide between the Beirut and Mount Lebanon area and at the center to the west, and the other remaining regions in Lebanon, particularly with regard to infrastructure coverage and income, basically. There's a major issue with extensive groundwater extraction and water resources pollution. So at the end of the 15 years of civil war, that was the picture: obsolete and degraded infrastructure, militia groups control, particularly of the water authorities and water services. The water authorities employees were really most for the majority either retired or about to retire, and during the 15 years of war and the multiple population displacements, this has resulted in fact in an organic growth in urban centers and suburbs, and an increased proliferation of illegal connections to the networks, and also groundwater extraction. So there are a number of factors that could be discussed in relation to the foreign context and actors. One is the what is called the water hegemony of Lebanon's neighbors, so Syria and Israel over the two transboundary rivers in Lebanon. Another aspect is actually also the regional and international power struggles of the day that are transposed through the local proxies onto the sectarian-based divisions of the government and contributing to in many cases, stalemate. But relevant to this particular talk, I'll focus on the donors' role. And so at the end of the 15-year civil war, the government turned to various bilateral and multilateral aid organizations for assistance in the reconstruction process and the rehabilitation of the public services, including the water sector. The Council for Development and Reconstruction, a government body created shortly after the start of the war in 1977, and charged with the execution of major aid-funded reconstruction projects, received over $12.5 billion US dollars in grants and soft loans between 1992 and 2014. It is estimated that around 14% of that amount, or about $2.2 billion, went to the water and wastewater sectors. So in the early 90s, international aid was pretty much focused on basic infrastructure rehabilitation of obsolete water distribution and wastewater networks. However, starting with the late 90s and in the year 2000, the donors' focus shifted to supporting the government in rolling out a reform of the water sector. This shift, in fact, reflects global trends in the development discourse, which pointed to an increased emphasis on the protection of the environment, with water as a central theme, and the emergence of a social dimension and participatory approach to development, while a strong neoliberal privatization paradigm persisted. So although the reform was presented under the Integrated Water Resources Management Sustainable Development paradigm promoted by the UN agencies and other donors, it was clearly aligned with and part of a technical assistance package to improve the Lebanese government fiscal health, with a clear focus on privatization. So indeed, and in parallel, and again with under donor pressure, according to the multiple accounts from the interviews, a privatization framework law was also passed in the same year, in 2000, and as reported, by the donors. In this slide, it just shows the projection of the global development discourse and trends in aid, water resources management, so how they actually were projected onto the local water management landscape. In particular, it particularly shows how the termination of the Beirut concession, the Beirut concession between the 1950s and 1970s, coincided and the creation of the Ministry of Hydraulic and Ministry of Agriculture actually coincided with a global trend of creation of public enterprises and what is known as the hydraulic mission, or harnessing the power of water for development. Law 221, on the other hand, is the donor's interpretation of the integrated water resources management global paradigm, and as well as the privatization momentum of the 1990s. So Lebanon transitioned from 400 plus years of Ottoman control to a French protectorate regime and became independent in 1943. As such, the country's laws and institutional arrangements in general and in particular with regards to water management carry a heavy legacy of overlapping, sometimes contradictory, customary Islamic, Ottoman, and French colonial laws. The evolution of the water laws since the 19th century actually reflect the Ottoman legal and political systems of evolution, particularly with the establishments of water rights and later on the first water concession in Beirut in the late 1800s. And through time, acquired and beneficiary water rights were gradually established, and they replaced the original Islamic principle of open access to water. The 19th century Ottoman code, called the Mejelle, inspired by the Napoleonic code, also established a principle of state ownership, and which. Aside from its applicability to large water bodies such as rivers and lakes, leaves a gap and remains liberal and vague when it comes to water sources on private land. And this, in fact, has gradually promoted a more capitalist sort of rent-based character of the water use in Lebanon. So this the table, and I apologize if you can, it's not quite readable at the back, this represents the water created water establishments, and I'll talk about that now. The first, so the first water establishment or water authority service in Lebanon was created back in 1870. Based on an Ottoman decree which granted a French engineer the concession over the Nahr el-Kalb River to supply part of the growing city of Beirut with water. In 1951, the government revoked those concessional privileges and created the first Beirut Water Authority. And since then, there's been, between that time and the year 2000, another 22 authorities were created, plus Litani River Water Authority. And during the war, there was a proliferation of water users committees for agriculture or domestic purposes. And so against this background, the year 2000, Law 221 actually consolidated all those pre-existing water authorities and water committees into the four water establishments to the left. The law first created five regional establishments, not four, according to the interviewees and the amendments are out there. And despite the fact that external consultants working with the donors at the time actually suggested just limiting those establishments to two because that meant that they were more attractive for potential privatization plan. However, because of the distributive concern and the fact that politicians considered that that would give them the ability to distribute the establishments across the various sites, they were kept initially at five, but under donor pressure, the number was brought down to four. Initially also, the water establishments did not include the management of wastewater management, which is basically a principle under integrated water resources management. And that was according again to a number of interviewees because of the presence in office in the Minister of the Minister of Interior, who had the custody of the municipalities, was actually a strong ally of Syria, and again, according to the interviews, perceived and considered that keeping the wastewater management function under the ministry would provide him with access to basically control over potential public works in that area. The implementation of the bylaws associated with the new law, again, the bylaws took a lot of time and were delayed. So the law was issued in 2000. The bylaws were delayed. And again, according to the accounts, it was due to a disagreement between the pro-Syrian Shia representatives in the government and the pro-West Sunnis, led by the ex-prime minister Hariri, seen as a supporter of the reform. Later on in 2005, Hariri was assassinated and the bylaws were finally issued in great haste with a number of typos, according, again, quoting one of the interviewees. And that was to basically secure urgent disbursements that donors threatened to withhold if the bylaws were not signed. So the law actually consolidated all the water authorities into four committees, and the Litani Water Authority was left out of that. And this, of course, will lead to a number of issues, as I will discuss later. And it was thought, again, at the time that the Litani Water Authority was left out of the consolidation plan for political considerations. So the reform introduced significant institutional and organizational changes to the sector. For example, while historically water authorities managed either domestic or irrigation water services, or both, wastewater has always been under the municipalities and the Ministry of Interior jurisdiction. Although the law abolished the water users committees, which used to provide a vehicle for water users to participate in the management of local water resources, again, in contradiction with the integrated water resources stated principles. So another apology for this slide, but really it's a table that shows the complexity of the landscape. And because after Law 221, a number of other legislative texts with some bearing over the water sector and over the water and wastewater sectors were issued over the past decade, and they assigned different institutional actors and stakeholders with similar roles in the management of specific aspects of the sector. And the laws often disregarded clearly drawing institutional boundaries of responsibilities and omitting to disambiguate the confusion resulting from pre-existing laws or obsolete mandates persisting alongside the more recent ones. So the table summarizes the involvement of those many institutional actors in the various aspects of the management of the water sector. And it contrasts between legislative and actual practice, because in many cases, what was happening on the ground was not what was in the legal text. For example, the Ministry of Energy and Water, the water establishments, the Litani River Authority and the CDR all have in their mandates execution of water projects. Wastewater management is a responsibility that's also assigned to the water establishments without any laws that clearly stipulate that they are no longer the responsibility of the municipalities. So a lot of confusion. And to illustrate, so on privatization, for example, I'm trying to sort of demonstrate the complexity of the unfolding of the reform. And for example, with regards to privatization, in 2003, to support the bundled reforms, the French government offered an assistance package to the Lebanese government to engage a private service provider to manage one of the water newly created water establishments. The selected provider was a Lebanese company created as a subsidiary of Suez Environnement, the French multinational operator. The selected area was Tripoli and the north, which is a Sunni stronghold and supporter of PM Prime Minister Hariri, who incidentally happens to be a close ally of the then president, French President Chirac. The Council for Development and Reconstruction was involved to oversee the contract execution, and the existing management of the establishment was appointed by the government, were requested to cooperate basically with the operator. The immaturity of the existing legislation at the time with regards to providing a privatization framework led to the establishment of a service management contract instead of the originally planned delegated management. The establishment itself was lacking in capability and capacity, basically. So nevertheless, during the 4 years of the contract, there were some improvements to the network and collection of water fees, but the contract was not renewed after those initial 4 years. And according to, again, a number of interviewees, the issues reported on were overlapping and blurred responsibilities, lack of skills, pressure to appoint staff based on political loyalties as opposed to skills, and lack of or weak law enforcement in support of collection and elimination of illegal connections. The interviewees included mentioned a number of references to sectarianism as an issue. For example, a resistance from certain groups to cooperate with the water establishments in terms of having legal network connections, for example, or stopping groundwater extraction. and these groups were protected in their resistance from the political leaders, who also act as gatekeepers to any services directed to the communities they represent. Law 221, I'll probably skip this one, just mention, conscious of the time. I'll touch on the absorptive capacity, which is an important aspect, the ability of the created establishments to assume the increased responsibilities introduced by the law was mentioned as a prevalent issue. The establishments had an extensive number of vacancies with aging staff or retired, and the remaining were actually aging staff about to retire. So as a result, the technical assistance provided by the donors was often not leveraged adequately to build local expertise. Also, with the CDR, the Council for Development and Reconstruction, being charged with the implementation of most of the donor-funded projects because donors were seeking efficiency in executing the project, that sort of contributed to the lack, to the inability of the establishment to build their capacity to assume the services. So the combination of post-war and weak state and the sectarian power-sharing regime has worsened the institutional fragmentation and incoherence and further complicated the motivational and information asymmetries and the incentive structures and linkages between the various actors. The role of the Council for Development and Reconstruction is to actually expedite the implementation of its projects, actually created some complex relationships between the donors and the recipient sectors, ministries, and bodies from an alignment and ownership perspective. And also more challenging and more critical was and still is the sectarian power sharing style of governance that has had a significant and detrimental effect on development of all sectors in general and including water, due to the political sectarian elite's capture of all state resources through a system of patronage and rent distribution. Sustainability outcomes after 12 years, I'll just touch on that. From an economic perspective, just minor improvement in operational efficiency within the establishment and still poor cost recovery and commercial efficiency. From an environmental perspective, there's continued degradation and continued over-extraction and pollution of the resources. And from the social perspective, there was evidence of a significant impact on human well-being, equity, and fairness, in addition to low social capital. This was certainly apparent in the household survey results, which also indicated so high costs for procuring water, lack of reform awareness, low concern in general among the population about resource scarcity, and low trust in the public water service and low trust in government. A final few comments on aid conditionality. So the accounts and the secondary resources reviewed clearly indicate a relationship between the sort of promotion of the reform or the initiation of the reform and the Paris 1, 2, and 3 donor conferences for Lebanon, which pledged soft loans and grants to alleviate Lebanon's fiscal deficit, but that was in return of the government commitment to implement a number of reforms, mostly focused on the reduction, mostly focused on privatization. But the analysis of the text of the law reveals obvious emphasis on the economic dimension of sustainability and, pretty much aligned with an overarching managerialistic privatization sort of impetus. Also interesting was the fact that aid funds were often unlocked to support the implementation of a number of ratified international treaties which Lebanon became signatory of, but unfortunately, because of the lack of capacity, these funds were not optimally leveraged. And from an effectiveness perspective, so ownership was an issue. And in many references actually suggest that it was more of a donor's issue than of a donor's agenda, the reforms and the aid followed more the donor's agenda, particularly prioritizing, for example, an example is with the EuroMed donors and their focus on basically wastewater treatment along the Mediterranean, whereas in Lebanon, because of the porous sort of topology and the snowfall on the mountain, it was very important to actually do the treatment where the water is. Alignment is also was limited, not only because of donors often following generic sort of global trends, but also because of the lack of political capacity to put forward a technical, a Lebanese agenda. I already touched on absorptive capacity. And to conclude, while aid conditionality can be effective in breaking consensus deadlocks, in a power-sharing democracy and formally introducing a reform, the findings have really highlighted that when a transplanted development trends and paradigms are imposed on a weak and divided recipient state, they can lead to a reduction in institutional coherence. This lack of coherence starts with ambiguous, in the case of Lebanon, ambiguous reform formulation, translates into chaotic implementation, and actually further weakening of existing institutions because of that. The weak state political elite coalescence that maintains a precarious and constantly renegotiated consensus and ruling over deeply segregated constituency is not supportive of political, economic, or even policy entrepreneurship that would bring any major change, as that would require supportive and widely accepted national values, which need to transcend consociational divides to form a cross-cutting and favorable advocacy for reform policies. Two last quick points on aid. Under a weak state, consociational democracy and aid dependency, political elites and community leaders are usually more prone to distributive conflicts and also playing the double role of gatekeepers in the national consensus game, as well as rent providers for the respective communities. So as such, these elites have critical influence on reform processes and outcomes. And finally, the consociational sectarian elite members are commonly supported by foreign affiliations, some bilateral aid initiatives and projects run an increased risk of being blocked by the lack of consensus among the elite members. So multilateral aid in such cases is better received, as it gives more of a sense of an impartiality. Thank you.
Well, thanks very much. You covered a lot there. Somewhat depressing. Would anyone like to ask a question or make a comment? Yeah.
Sure. So that slide where you had the assistance from donors, it looked like a very fragmented donor landscape. So I just wanted to ask, was there a particular donor or a particular set of donors that were pushing reforms in Lebanon? And were the, I guess, were the donor conditionalities always coherent, or were there contradictions as well between what different donors were wanting?
Again, according to the interviews and initially in the late 90s, it was mostly the World Bank suggesting this raft of reforms that covered other sectors as well, but really focused on having a privatization framework. But there was certainly in the sector a dominant presence of GIZ and AFD, Agence Française de Développement, and whether they were sort of supporting that because Lebanon was a French protectorate historically, so there's this relationship with France, but there's also, as it happens at that during that time, Prime Minister Rafik Hariri had a close alliance with France, and just the fact that the whole privatization experience was led by or funded with a French grant, which led to the involvement of a French company. So that really, that obviously shows a strong role of the French aid in that area. But yeah, they were all European donors mostly were pushing for the establishment of those water establishments and integrated IWRM was the mantra.
Was this $2 billion, was it some of it spent on investments, which are actually quite useful, or was it mainly spent on technical assistance, which
so the,
really hasn't had
any? So there are a number of projects, rehabilitation of infrastructure works and networks. More recently, after, so in 2014, the World Bank, which is after stock data collection, the World Bank actually approved a loan to to build another large dam on the Litani River, still contested because it seems like Lebanon is starting to build dams at a time where other countries are dismantling dams. But the fact is there is no, very little water capture. And but yeah, so it's sort of a reversal of in the late 90s, early 2000, there was a definite shift away from major infrastructures. So that's a sort of reversal, or have we stopped the hydraulic mission too early for Lebanon? It already missed, maybe because of the 15 years of civil war, it actually missed on its chance to build the water sector structures required. So, but a lot of it was technical assistance, which created a lot of issues because there were so many vacancies in the public sector. And even when, and obviously there was the syndrome of the foreign consultant coming into the establishment and sort of spreading his or her wisdom and then disappearing. So there were a number of references to that.
Yeah, sure.
My question is, what was the role of international NGOs in this context in terms of being recipients of donor aid because they advocate as, you know, their activities in the war, and not just as recipients, but in terms of that dynamic?
Actually, they played a very interesting role, which I haven't touched on. But so they certainly sort of had a bit of an entrepreneur role in facilitating, in compensating for some of the institutional void that was created by the reform. So, for example, the mere fact of this is establishing the water user committees and sort of removing that channel of participation for local communities created many issues, particularly with the removal of, again, of the municipalities as an actor. So in those cases, there are many examples where like local and international NGOs have actually stepped in and negotiated sort of localized arrangements that included the water establishment, the municipality with a certain role. And these were actually successful, where the municipality had some ownership. They were also able to, there were a few examples where an NGO would actually broker a local sharing arrangement between, say, a Christian village and a Muslim village, being sort of an impartial broker, provided some assistance to create an initial structure to organize some sort of a committee. And what was interesting is that because the law didn't include any references to user water user committees, the NGOs started supporting local communities with the creation of cooperatives, because there's a law for cooperatives. So there's a number of cooperatives that sort of compensate for the missing water user committees.
Yes, so I want to know the nature of transboundary issues, if there are any.
So, basically, obviously, the Middle East is a known is known for its water scarcity. Israel has known. There's many reports in the literature about water issues in the region, and for example, the Israeli capture of water resources in Palestine, and so with regards to Lebanon, there's two transboundary rivers. One is the Orontes, which goes into Syria, and the other one is the a tributary of the Jordan River, the Hasbani River. And in fact, Israel has actually prevented militarily Lebanon from exploiting any of those waters that are tributaries of the Jordan River. Israel invaded Lebanon on a number of occasions, and there's always in the literature, in the media, everywhere, accounts of Israel aiming to capture the Litani Water River, which incidentally comes very close to the Israeli borders and then shifts right or left into the Mediterranean. And that's basically the sort of transboundary issues with Syria, because Syria was actually in sort of an occupying power in Lebanon until much of the 70s and until 2005. The negotiated agreement on the use of the Orontes River, which crosses the boundaries into Syria, was one very much to the advantage of Syria. So,
questions? Yeah.
You mentioned that the agriculture use took up around 60-70% of the water. Are there sectarian issues on the agricultural reform side to me? Is the largest sector having the most agricultural land there? And if in that case, what kind of, what are the more policies focused on the engineering-dominated supply-side approach rather than focusing on demand-side management, especially to contribute to agriculture?
Yeah, so with agriculture and irrigation, there's an increasing awareness of the fact that Lebanon exports a lot of its water in the shape of virtual water, so in as fruits or vegetables, particularly to the Gulf. And what this shows is actually the lack of strategic planning for the use of water, which is an obvious fact in Lebanon. Whether there are sectarian issues in relation to water, to agricultural water. So the Bekaa Valley and the South have a majoritarian Shia population. And for example, the reason some accounts have mentioned that the reason that the Litani River Authority was sort of left out of the consolidation plan was because it was protected by the Shia political elite in the government and sort of a way again to distribute rent. And for many years, the the Minister of Agriculture would be actually a representative of Hezbollah. So there are interesting dynamics there.
I mean, if I was to try to sum up this complex story, it would be that there was a bunch of donors who thought there really needed to be some reforms in the water sector. They pushed through these reforms, which were adopted, but which never really had much of an effect. Right? Well,
it's even worse than not having an effect, I think, because what they did, they actually created in some places more complex institutional arrangements and lack of actually coherence with people lost as to, like, till now, and we are in 2016, users, in the villages, if anyone has an issue with the wastewater connection, they would talk to the municipality. So there's sort of, it almost looks like you need us to push reforms to give us the money. Here are the reforms, but unfortunately, you end up with a not necessarily an improved situation. So,
So the donors came along, they pushed these reforms, and maybe they made things worse, right? Created a whole lot of confusion.
Yes, so it's not about ticking a box, I think. It's
What I want to ask is, I mean, because, you know, we just had David Booth, right, talk about the importance of political analysis. I mean, was there any evidence, any donor sort of sat and thought, well, what are the politics of reform? How likely is it in this incredibly complex political setup and institutional setup that this reform is going to succeed? Did anyone do any political analysis on the donor side?
Actually, they would probably say that they did. From the donors I interviewed, they always said that they are aligned with the sort of trying to respond to the needs, but if you look at how the number of establishments evolved, I'm not sure if the donors back then thought, okay, let them start with five and we will see. Let them start without wastewater and then we will add it. If that was their sort of political economy approach, let's see if they progressively get to that point, mm-hmm. and so on. So I guess another point I want to make at the end is that this sectarian political system is sort of has been suggested as a solution by the American Provisionary Coalition Provisionary Coalition in Iraq, and it resulted in a sectarian political system, and it's being sort of thought of as a potential solution for the Syrian conflict. So just these findings, one with Lebanon, which has a history of such a sort of power-sharing, sectarian-based system since the 1800s, basically. It shows that there's always cyclical returns to violence, and also there are many potentials for traps to provide an environment that's prone to being exploited by the political elite and what happens is that the political elite doesn't have any incentives to change that.
Well, we're pretty much out of time. Yeah, it does remind me, some of us work on Papua New Guinea, which is an environment where it's difficult to get reforms to work. And I imagine in Lebanon, it's not just the water sector, right? Other sectors must also be very difficult to reform because of the political setup.
You probably haven't seen on the CNN the picture of the garbage river.
Yeah.
Some may have seen it. So, it's like the same thing. It's the various community representatives in the government really pushing to the limit, negotiating at the expense of really just what's in it for me.
Yeah, so you've got an environment where it's very difficult to do reforms. You've got a bunch of donors whose mandate is to promote reform. And the result
so
is
I think, and obviously this is like, what's next? And anyone interested in sort of moving forward with a new research project on exploring how they're going, for example, how aid for achieving the sustainable development goals will sort of unfold in Lebanon. The interesting thing is that there's an obviously, and finally, an increased emphasis on governance and but how will that unfold is an interesting question.
All right, so very interesting, sobering tale. Thanks very much, Rim, for sharing with us. Please join me thanking
you. Thank you.
You have been listening to a podcast from the Development Policy Centre. For more information on our work, visit our website at devpolicy.anu.edu.au. To join the conversation on Australian aid, Papua New Guinea and the Pacific, and global development policy, visit our blog at devpolicy.org. At the blog, you can also sign up to our newsletter for all the latest updates or connect with us on social media. Thanks for listening.